It's 8:06 on this Wednesday, March 12th. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. Currently, we've got 30 degrees here in Old Town Park City and mostly sunny skies. Heber City reporting 33 degrees. On the phone with us now from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. Yeah, we're dealing with a beautiful start to the day. Temperatures not too cold out there, but overall, we can enjoy that as we're going to be seeing temperatures warming up later on today with that sunshine. We'll see highs in the upper 40s there for Park City with highs in the low to mid 50s as you get towards the Heber Valley. Now, we will see some clouds starting to sneak in from the south and southwest as we go throughout today. So we'll call it partly sunny skies. It may be maybe a more of a mostly cloudy sky by late today in the Heber Valley, but overall, it should still be pretty nice. Now, another thing you're going to notice, the winds are going to start to pick up. We're looking at those wind gusting up to about 30 to 35 miles per hour this afternoon as they come in out of the south and west. That'll help get those temperatures up as well. And that's ahead of our storm system that's going to begin to bring us some big changes as we go into the rest of the week. So enjoy today, because as we go into tonight, those clouds will thicken up. And as we go into your Thursday, we'll start off with some scattered snow showers around Park City and some scattered rain showers there in the Heber Valley, as temperatures will be flirting with the freezing mark in the Heber Valley, with temperatures right around freezing in Park City. And then as we go throughout the day, we're expecting off and on snow showers to increase around the Park City area. But as you're in the Heber Valley, it could be more of a rain-snow mix. So just kind of keep that in mind. May see some periods of rain at time with better chances of a few snow showers mixing in as we get into the afternoon hours. Now, in Park City, it'll be all snow. So that means that we could be talking about some accumulations an inch or two as we go throughout the day on Thursday. Now, as we get into Thursday evening, those snow levels are going to plummet. The cold air is going to work its way in. And that means even in the Heber Valley, we're going to quickly flip over to snow. And that's when we'll likely see probably about 1 to 3 inches in the Heber Valley. And we could be looking at snow accumulations there in Park City continuing and probably ending up with a total of about 4 to 8 inches in Park City. By the time we get towards Friday morning, the Heber Valley could have more in that 2 to 4 inch range. So we'll call it 2 to 4 inches for this first system in the Heber Valley. And again, about 4 to 8 inches as you get up towards Park City. So it's going to be another little decent thump of snow. It'll be a quick hitting event, but it'll be a decent event. Now, as we go into your Friday morning, could have a couple of scattered snow showers, but we'll begin to dry things out pretty quickly, but it'll be chilly. Highs will likely stay below freezing in Park City, with highs only in the mid to upper 30s for the Heber Valley. Now, we're not done with winter yet, so if that's not enough snow for you, as we go into your Saturday, we're tracking, you guessed it, yet another storm system, and this one will be a colder storm system. So that means this one will start and finish as all snow as we go into your Saturday. We'll start off with temperatures into the lower 20s in the Heber Valley, temperatures in the upper teens and low 20s in Park City, and we'll see those highs only into the low 30s as we get into your Saturday afternoon. Again, with that snow becoming likely, that system could also bring an additional 4 to 8 inches for Park City and snow totals around 2 to 4 inches for the Heber Valley. So again, another decent quick hitting, but a nice thump of snow coming our way with yet another system, Leslie, as we get towards the beginning of next week. So it was quiet for winter, but now that we're getting closer to spring, it's changing.
Yeah, sure is. Okay, Cedric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And with a look in the backcountry on the phone with us, we have Paige. Good morning, Paige.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great, thank you.
All right. It's been pretty quiet in the backcountry with this warm weather and not so much snow. Today, the avalanche danger is moderate on upper and mid-elevation steep slopes, mainly due to the incoming strong winds today. Believe it or not, there's actually enough loose snow to move around that might form some wind slabs up near the lee ridge lines and maybe around terrain features. We haven't had too much recent activity, mostly wet loose activity, but that's starting to wind down. Last night's temperatures cooled down enough to maybe lock up some of that wet snow. Again, today we're more concerned with wind-drifted snow with those strong winds, like Cedric mentioned, from the south, that should be moving around snow in the alpine and creating slabs of wind-drifted snow. We're still concerned about persistent weak layers. We've been beating that drum all winter, but they are still reactive in our stability tests. And if people want to get into steep terrain, mostly on the north half of the compass, they should probably get their shovel out and dig a pit and see if those facets are reactive or not. But otherwise, quiet day today, and we expect increasing avalanche danger with the incoming storm tomorrow.
Okay, Paige, thank you.
You bet. Bye.
Well, coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, stay tuned. I'll be checking in with the executive director of Peace House, Kendra Wyckoff, with her concerns about future funding. Park City Manager Matt Dye is previewing this week's City Council meeting, and we'll also hear from Heber Valley Executive Director Dallin Kosher with a look at some upcoming chamber events. Then stay tuned for The Mountain Life. Today's guests include veteran educator Dr. Mort Sherman and accomplished musician and educator Sarah Sherman, talking about how music can be integrated in our daily lives in a more conscious, purposeful way. Then the owners of Avanto Spa highlight the benefits of contrast therapy. This is a method of temperature-based water therapy. All of that coming up on The Mountain Life. You can hear Mountain Life every Wednesday at 9. Well, Utah lawmakers passed a bill in the 11th hour of the session that will reshape the Summit County Council. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports it says at-large council members must be elected by districts, not the entire county.
House Bill 356, sponsored by South Jordan Republican Representative Jordan Tusher, was passed at 11:57 p.m., the third-to-last bill pushed through before the 2025 General Session's midnight close Friday. It requires Summit County to elect its council members from five voting districts. Currently, all the seats are at large. On KPCW's Local News Hour Tuesday, Deputy Summit County Manager Jana Young called HB 356 a, quote, shameful political stunt with no integrity to community involvement or transparency. She claims county officials were assured the bill was dead before it was revived in the final days of the session.
We were never told who was behind the effort or their connection to the bill sponsor. We now know that the Summit County Republicans were behind the bill and working with our legislators behind our backs, even though our legislators purported to be helping us. We were wondering why hide it from us. You know, we could have had a conversation about it, studied it with our community, engaged other voters, and possibly come up with a collaborative bill together.
HB 356 initially would have reverted Cache County back to a three-member commission as well, but that provision was dropped. The bill that ultimately passed only deals with Summit County's form of government. Tori Welch, the Summit County GOP's representative to the State Central Committee, says the County Republican Party did not take an official position on the bill.
I don't think there was any formal position on it, but informally, I think for the most part, yeah, everybody was quite supportive of it. There were some individuals who are not necessarily associated with the party as far as leadership or executive team or anything like that, that were certainly pushing for it.
Welch and Ari Ioannidis were the main Republican challengers to the West Side Democrats who won the November 2024 election. Both men live in northern Summit County. Ioannidis received cheers at the 2024 County GOP convention when he raised the idea of three districted and two at-large seats. HB 356 is written so that all five seats would be districted, and Ioannidis told KPCW it's a good thing for the people of Summit County, which is the only county in Utah using the council form of government that is not districted. Tusher agrees that it's about giving Eastern Summit County a voice. Currently, all but one county council member live in the Park City area, and all are Democrats. The rural east side tends to vote red, and it tended to vote against changing the three-person at-large commission to a five-person council in 2006.
It's really easy for the large urban area to overpower all of the rural area, and the rural voice just doesn't get heard.
Welch also says HB 356 means it will cost less to run for council because candidates need only campaign in their district rather than the whole county.
The previous system kind of created perverse incentives, which really brought, you know, people who were either very wealthy or very well connected, made it a lot easier for them and a lot more difficult for your average citizens.
But Young thinks the bill is caving to special interests, not casting them aside.
And I think regardless of your preference or personal philosophy on this issue, it feels wrong that a small group of voters with connections to the legislature have the power to decide this issue for the entire community.
Young didn't get called on during public comment when HB 356 was being reviewed in the House Political Subdivisions Committee. It got pulled from committee in the Senate, so no one got to weigh in then. Before the Senate passed it at 10:45 p.m. Friday night, Salt Lake City Democrat Senator Jen Plum said she just received emails from concerned Summit County representatives.
When they made the decision to go to all at large in 2006, that had been a voter decision, and they didn't feel particularly great about us kind of usurping that.
The Senate then passed the bill in a mostly party line vote, and the House concurred an hour later at 11:57. Summit County's Republican Senator Ron Winterton voted against the bill, and GOP Representative Mike Kohler, representing the Park City area, abstained or was absent in the House. Eastern Summit County GOP Representative Tiara Oxier voted for the bill. Here's Young.
You know, we often brush off late night surprises on the last day of the legislative session as, well, that's just politics, or that's how things are done in the legislature, but it's not right, it's not ethical, it's not transparent government, and we should expect and demand better from our elected representatives.
House Bill 356 is on the desk of Governor Spencer Cox, who had not vetoed a single 2025 bill as of March 11th. At first, the bill would have ended the current council members' terms in 2026. Now they may serve out the rest of their current terms, but which district they represent will be decided by lottery. If the law takes effect May 7th, the districting commission to draw the five voting areas must be up and running by June. The commission would include Summit County's mayors, one resident of the unincorporated county, and the county clerk. County officials have pointed out that districts would need to be roughly proportional in population, which may mean including West Side neighborhoods in East Side districts. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, as part of its cost-cutting budget, in order to offer a slight decrease in the income tax percentage, Utah lawmakers slashed funding for domestic and sexual violence programs. Some programs were passed over altogether. In the studio to talk about what Peace House is facing as a result of this, I have the executive director, Kendra Wyckoff. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So this news comes, I guess, as you're seeing increased needs?
Yeah, absolutely. We have really just over the last 5 years, you know, since our campus opened, continued to see an increased need for services. So we've never hit a plateau. Every year over year, we have an increase in people engaging in support. And I think most impactful and really important has been some legislative mandates around the lethality assessment protocol, which is a protocol that law enforcement utilize to identify survivors at highest risk when they respond to a domestic violence call. Because that's now mandated, and we are really glad that it's mandated because it's such a critical part of safety for survivors, it has also resulted in increases. So we've seen a 65% increase in the number of referrals directly coming from law enforcement. And that's significant because not only are we responding to each of those calls, then those folks are also engaging in services at about a rate of 40%.
So in terms of the numbers that you're seeing, How many?
Yeah, well, we're seeing on average about 500 survivors. I mean, we used to see about 350. In the last 2 years, we're pushing at 500. Right now, I can tell you this year, we'll probably exceed that amount. And I think that that's significant. You know, generally, we're seeing about a 10 to 25% increase year over year over the past 5 years.
So how will Peace House be impacted by the legislature's action this session, if at all?
Yeah, well, we will be impacted. One of the appropriations was specifically meant to help build increased capacity because of that LAP implementation. And that funding was, you know, at about $1.4 million that we asked for. Social Services Appropriations Committee funded it at $1.3. So we're very hopeful that we were going to see some additional funding coming to programs in Utah and specifically to Peace House. And unfortunately, when it got to executive appropriations, it was cut altogether. And so as we're continuing to see those increased needs coming in with LAP, this funding was intended to help us fill some of those gaps that we may experience because those needs are getting greater and greater year over year. And what I can tell you, Leslie, is that our programs were already at capacity before the mandate. And we want to ensure that survivors have the services and the safety and support that they need.
So of that 1.4 that you were, how much came to Peace House out of that? Because that was kind of statewide.
Yeah,
right?
That is statewide. But generally, those funds are done on a formula based on the number of services that we provide. But I could tell you that, you know, we could generally see maybe a $50,000 to $70,000 increase in funding if that would have passed. And that's significant. You know, that could be another position to help support capacity. That could be another legal advocate. That could be another case manager to ensure that we have enough staff to keep up with the needs that are coming coming in on our helpline and through our doors.
Well, talk a little bit about where your funding does come from.
Yeah, about 45% of our funding comes from government contracts and grants. Some of those are sole source contracts. Many of them are competitive grants as well that are actually federal pass-through monies that come through a state office. And then we see about 25% of our funding that comes from our special events that we put on every year, our annual appeal, our spring luncheon. And lastly, the remainder is really from the community, private philanthropic folks that want to give. This can come in the form through foundations, corporations, and individuals.
So how do you make up? I mean, do you know what you're going to have a loss? I mean, this was just extra money that you were hoping for.
Right. Well, I think where our challenge is right now is that with some of the recent federal mandates, those dollars that come through as federal pass-through dollars from the Violence Against Women Office, from the Office of Victims of Crime, and the Family Violence Prevention Services Office, those funds are significant. And they come through and they provide about $400,000 in support specifically to Peace House on an annual basis. Right now, we don't know what the status is. You know, we're completing our current contract year that ends June 30th, I can tell you as part of our planning, we were really looking forward to applying for some specific discretionary funds from the Office on Violence Against Women, started applications, and then, you know, as things started to roll out, those solicitations were removed from the website and there's no information. It just basically says, you know, don't submit your application, don't continue to work on it. I think that uncertainty is really what is putting us in a difficult place because we don't know what this means. We don't know what the short-term or long-term impacts are. We don't really have direction. I can tell you I've, you know, lived through moments where, you know, we've had a freeze because the budget didn't get passed at the congressional level. We've had losses in funding, but we've heard about those losses and we were able to make some adjustments, make some plans. But right now, we're sitting in a space with very little or no information and so much uncertainty, so we just don't know. And that's the challenge.
Well, so what do you do?
Right. So I think we work on a number of contingency plans. We lean into our supporters in the community. You know, we will be having our biggest fundraiser of the year at the spring luncheon. And we are asking for people to support our life-saving and life-changing services. We have to. You know, we have an unwavering commitment to ensure that every survivor in this community, when they're reaching out for help, can get help. And we have to find a way to make that happen. Whether we go to our community supporters, we look for different resources, and we do advocacy, you know, both at the state and federal level.
So was any reasoning given to you about the legislature's decision? I mean, again, it sounds like a program that's been supported.
Right. I mean, I think that's the challenging thing is that, you know, I reached out and had conversations with legislators. Many of my staff spent, you know, full days up at the advocacy days for our coalitions. And we had really strong support from our local legislators. They understand the need and they understand that these services require support from the state. So it's, you know, concerning that as it gets to executive appropriations, that the funding is lost. Like they could not find that additional funding to support these really core services in our communities. And I think that that's challenging because we don't necessarily know. We hear things like, you know, the lack of revenue this year, but we're also hearing, you know, the legislature was committed to cutting state taxes. So it's challenging when you're serving the most vulnerable communities and you're seeing that, you know, $1 or $2 million can make a significant difference in many communities, enabling us to continue to do the work that we're doing, and that's being cut at the state level.
Mm. You mentioned that some of the things that can be done is to look towards the community to help. You mentioned the spring luncheon coming up. Do you have tickets available still for that?
Yeah, we have a few tickets available. I encourage you get online, go to peacehouse.org right away. If you have questions about additional seats, you can always reach out to Sally Tauber at sally@peacehouse.org. She's just working on those final decisions. And then lastly, if you can't make it, we have an incredible opportunity this year. We have two wonderful lead sponsors that that are offering those sponsorships up as a matching grant. So we have the Vail Epic Promise, Park City Mountains, and the Marriott Daughters Foundation for a total of $50,000. So even if you can't come to the Spring Luncheon, you can get online, make a donation, just make a note, you know, Spring Luncheon match, and we can put that towards our match. And that will help double your impact and will help us where we're at right now concerning this uncertainty around funding.
All right. Talk a little bit about, I mean, if you don't get the federal funding that you're looking for, I mean, what do you do? I mean, do you turn people away? Do you start making layoffs? Do you, I mean, what's...
Yeah, I think that those are the tough decisions that, you know, are always on the table when you're working in a business that requires staffing and costs. We are committed to keeping our services where they're at the level that we currently have in our community. And we're going to work really, really hard. You know, as a nonprofit, we're creative and innovative. We can partner with our community partners here in Summit and Wasatch Counties to help fill in some of those gaps. We can identify some additional funding sources. We can lean into our community support. But at the end of the day, you know, there is, you know, the final line where we may have to look at specific areas where we might be able to have an opportunity to scale back. That is not ideal. That's never ideal. You know, we want to make sure our intervention services are at the forefront. Obviously, those core services, shelter, housing, legal advocacy, counseling, those need to remain intact. And it could mean that, you know, for example, prevention education, we might have to scale back in some of those areas. So we just are working on multiple contingency plans. But our hope is that, you know, we don't have to utilize those contingency plans and that we have the support that we need, that voices can be heard, and that our community will rally around survivors and ensure that these services are available, not just this year, but for years to come.
Yeah. I want to ask, I mean, given the need, the increased need that we are seeing year to year, we had recently heard of Wasatch County's interest in kind of starting its own domestic violence shelter. Has anything come out of that you're aware of?
Yeah, we've reached out, and we understand that there's a couple of, you know, key folks that are leading that effort, and we've let them know that we're happy to offer any technical assistance and support. Currently, we're doing a lot of outreach work in Wasatch County. We've seen 100% increase in the number of people coming from Wasatch County this past year. And I think that speaks volumes to the work that we're doing around awareness and outreach, but it also speaks volumes to the need in that community as well. And we always can utilize more capacity, absolutely. One of the things that I think is really key and important when we talk about the needs of survivors, though, is very much that comprehensive system of support. So as we are building shelters, we have to ensure that there are also pathways to housing in our community, because those spaces can become bottlenecks and can become dead ends sometimes if we don't have a continuing path to ensure that survivors have safe and affordable housing in our community as well.
Yeah. So what is your overnight capacity?
Our overnight capacity is 60 with both of our residential programs. And we're generally right there. You know, we have 12 apartments for transitional housing that are longer term. And we have 8 units of emergency shelter. And when all of those units are full and we have high danger victims calling for support or law enforcement officers making those referrals, our commitment is to ensure that we will find a safe place for those folks. So we utilize other alternatives. There have been times that we've had to use some of our swing suite rooms that don't maybe have a private bathroom temporarily overnight because it's 3 a.m. We've added cots to rooms. We have utilized hotels as an opportunity. So we might have a family that's in a situation where they're transitioning out and they might be able to stay in a hotel while we bring that high danger family in. So we're just constantly working to be as creative and innovative as possible. But I think those examples really highlight the fact that, you know, the need continues to grow and outgrow the capacity that we have.
Yeah, and of that 60, I mean, what's the Wasatch County count there?
I don't know right off the top of my head of those that are residing on our campus. It would be something that I'd have to take a look at. But I think in general, we're seeing, like, in our emergency shelter, or just across actually all of our programs, about 30 to 35% of the people are coming from Wasatch County and about 55 from Summit. And then we have like a small percent coming from outside the county. If they're not in a safe situation in another county, other, you know, spaces or facilities or at capacity, or their perpetrator has found them in another community, we certainly work with our sister programs across the state to ensure safety for anyone who lives in Utah.
Okay. Anything else you want to mention, Kendra?
I just want to say we're grateful for the support of this community. You know, we could not be here. We're coming up on our 30th anniversary this year. And it's really important for us to be here for another 30 years. So please, you know, continue to support us in the ways that you have. Reach out, check our website. There are lots of ways you can do this. And if you know someone who is affected by these issues, because I think that's equally important, right, to supporting Peace House, is supporting the individual survivors in your life. Make sure that they know how to get in touch with resources. Our hotline is 1-800-647-PEACE. 9161.
Okay, Kendra, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Kendra Wyckoff is the Executive Director of Peace House. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. The Park City Council meets Thursday, starting a work session at 3:10 in the studio with the meeting preview. Park City Manager Matt Dias, good morning.
Hi, Leslie. Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you. So first, let's get an update, if we will, from this year's legislative session. I know the city was watching a handful of bills. Anything that didn't go the city's way?
Well, there's always things that don't go the city's way. Obviously, it was a fast and furious finish, as I had alluded to before. I felt like the beginning of the session was very slow and very deliberate, and it really pushed things until the last week and a half. And that can get interesting because then the rules need to be suspended and bills make it to the floor without going through a committee and getting adequate transparency and vetting. So I've said that before. Primarily, though, the municipality is really focused on a few land use bills in particular. And we were focused on some voting bills in particular. You've covered most of those here, the ranked choice voting bill and the changes to the mail-in voting process. We were also very focused on the Beehive Development Agency bill that we were able to kick to an interim session and ensure that that bill didn't move forward. As we've talked about before, we focused on the venues bill or the major sporting venues bill that I've alluded to before. But really, like, you know, kind of three or four core land use bill, a bunch of changes to our election, formats, and then the development agency that we talked about that we were able to kick to interim session, and then the major sporting venues bill.
Yeah, so the land use, though, I mean, there was some talk about what it would move. It would move the lawsuit between Park City Municipal and the Princes in terms of getting their house built here in Old Town.
There's three different ones that we were focused on. One had to do with security measures at a private property anywhere in the state of Utah, and that there could be security issues that are presumably so pervasive that they require additional levels of confidentiality, and that would need to be certified by the executive director of the Department of Public Safety with Utah. That's a difficult thing for a municipality to say no to, that there'd be a security measure or measures that are so necessary, and it would warrant certification from a duly authorized, you know, governmental official that runs our security apparatus in the state of Utah. That's a difficult thing for us to fight. However, you know, we tried to maintain local land use control to the extent that we could and make sure that there wasn't just an attempt to do things that our codes wouldn't allow or to subvert our process. That did prevail. We also worked on another bill that seemed to enable some additional settlement authority for the legislative body, for councils and mayors across Utah. It doesn't compel them to have settlement authority. It provides some additional flexibility. And, you know, we sought to just maintain as much local flexibility and authority as we could. And I think, you know, we came out in a relatively neutral position on that. There was some compelling language in there or some language that would force us to do things initially. We were able to get that out of the bill. And then finally, you know, at the last minute, in sort of a very dramatic turn of events on the last night, there were some efforts again with our historic district. And this has happened sort of episodically over the last 5 to 7 years. There's a really important historic district down in the Salt Lake Valley, kind of the Yale, Harvard neighborhood, and there's a few in St. George and other areas in the state. And these are becoming more and more under scrutiny from legislators that tend to be pro-private property rights. Now, this last-minute legislation would have made some very material changes here in Park City, and fortunately, we were able to prevail.
Yeah, but I'm guessing now, does that lawsuit then march on, or will it get settled under one of these bills?
Oh, I don't know. The bill that I was talking about with settlement authority doesn't compel our council to do anything. It just gives them some additional flexibility. Now, that would be a discussion between a landowner or a private property owner and the legislative body, which is the mayor and council in this case. And that could happen on kind of numerous different types of land use issues. This wasn't germane to a specific one.
All right. Let's see. The city plans to do a full Main Street repaving, but that's been pushed back to next year. Why?
Well, fortunately, we're ahead of schedule on the water, the Main Street water project. Real quickly, this is a massive overhaul of the water infrastructure on Main Street, which includes a huge pipeline up the middle of Main Street, and then also every single individual lateral into every single property on Main Street. We've made it about halfway up Main Street. We're about halfway to go. We had planned this over 3 years. We think we can get it done in two, working with the Main Street business owners. That allowed us to do, instead of like a third, a third, a third, they allowed us to do a two in 1 year. So this next year, what we're gonna do is, once we finish the work, we're gonna start as soon as we can, but once we finish the work early summer, we're gonna come in and slurry seal the street. You know, the street's in pretty rough condition. If you drove it, I drove in this morning and I drove it. So a slurry seal can be a little bit misleading because people have the propensity to think it's the finished product, but really is it's just like oil aggregate solution, and it actually doesn't look great for a couple days, sometimes even a week. But, you know, 20 days out, 45 days out, you know, it sort of looks like a new street. So we're going to have this temporary measure for this summer. We come in and slurry seal the street, and we'll come back next year and do a full mill grind, overlay all the utility heads, all the manhole covers. But that will allow a period for compaction. So when you do a water project of this magnitude, there's a lot of soil and fill that goes around the utilities that are under the road. And you want to allow a little bit of time for that material to slough or just exist in the natural environment, experience frost, rain, snow. And there, you know, from time to time are some compaction issues. You give a year for that to hold, and then you come back in and do like the 10 to 15 year project all at once.
Okay. Later, the council will vote to approve a $309,000 overhead electric charging system for city buses. Looks like this is going to be installed near the Public Works building on Short Line Road. So will buses just pull to the side of Short Line, or will there be some cutout made to keep the buses out of the traffic lane?
Both. And they already do already today. That's a big depot spot for our drivers where they transition in and out of buses. And there's a little holding spot there. We're going to improve that. But this will really just improve our overall efficiency, getting additional charges, and we can keep those buses on the road longer.
Okay. The pedestrian crossing alternatives on Kearns Boulevard, we'll get an update. We've got three options. One, do nothing, and then just kind of reassess after the redevelopment of private property. I'm assuming that DoubleTree Yarrow is what you're considering. Number two is to construct a tunnel, which I saw a price tag of between $16 and $18 million, much more than the city actually has in the bank to do that, or to use an at-grade hot crossing like we have in front of the Fresh Market. That's at about a $500,000 to $800,000 expense. So what's the recommendation here?
I don't believe we have one. I think if you were to just approach this from a pure safety perspective and had no fiscal constraints or otherwise, or worried about construction mitigation, this, that, and the other, it'd be a tunnel. A tunnel is the safest alternative. However, we were aware of a pending rule change with UDOT. And so we were aware that they were updating their warrants and their methodology and their criteria about where, how, and when they allow at-grade crossings. As a reminder, this isn't our road, it's a UDOT road. And council was interested in alternatives. So we probably could have produced this report, you know, 4 months ago, 3.5 months ago, but we held out a little bit, and in fact, the UDOT rules changed. And so there is an at-grade crossing, very similar to the one that you mentioned, that would be a viable alternative. Here's the catch. As you mentioned, the development pattern in this area is going to be significant in the next 10 years. I mean, the Yarrow is but one that could potentially redevelop, as well as our 5-acre property. There's the movie theater there. So there's a lot of development occurring in this area. And when you're doing a project of this magnitude, you don't want to miss an opportunity where you could have coordinated better. And maybe that means the tunnel would have moved over 60 feet or 600 feet or this, that, and the other. So, you know, there's some propensity to not want to spend a lot of money and then find out 2 years later there was an opportunity. We could have waited a little bit. So if we were to move forward on the at-grade crossing, there's a catch too, which is that, you know, UDOT, to make that level of investment would require some type of reimbursement from us. So if they were to go in and overhaul the infrastructure in that area for an at-grade crossing, and then a year and a half later we want to tear it out, we would be on the hook for that. This is one of those times that the mayor and council is a tough decision to make. Do we get ahead of the development pattern and put in the infrastructure? Or do we wait for it and do an interim solution knowing we might have to make a reimbursement? It's just a tough decision to make. I think everyone's committed to the safety at this intersection. I'm happy that our staff held on a little here and waited for this rule change to come because it gives our elected officials more choices.
Yeah. Any concern, though? I mean, we already see Kearns Boulevard back up to Park Avenue there. I mean, if you've got now traffic stopped for people to cross, I mean, just nowhere to put the cars because they're backed all the way up to the resort.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I thought about that, you know, yesterday morning when I was dropping my kids off, you know, I was stuck in a little bit of traffic because kids were crossing the road. Well, you know, in this, there's a hierarchy of needs on that road, and getting traffic in and out is one of them. People have to get to work, or they want to go skiing, or they have to grab their kids at school. And we also have to prioritize the needs of pedestrians to cross the street. And there's a balancing act here. I don't know, you know, where the pendulum swings on this. I believe the one on 224 actually... at the Fresh Market, functions at a pretty high level and provides a great deal of safety. Now, it's not as safe as a tunnel. We made a choice there. But so, look, at times there are going to be interruptions and traffic and congestion in this community because of the way our roads are constructed and because of our economy and our job base and our housing sector. There's numerous reasons we have traffic and congestion on that road. We don't want to make it any worse, but sometimes you have to prioritize needs.
Okay. Let's see. Ranked choice voting. Is this ready for a vote? By council?
Potentially. I think it's probably just another working meeting and conversation. Unfortunately, the ranked choice voting pilot program was not extended by the Utah legislature. So this would be the last year that our municipality, as it is currently conceived in law, could pursue ranked choice voting. So we'll have a work session. We'll have an update on the legislation. If we were to move to ranked choice voting, it is something we'd need to do. I think that deadline is May for the 2025 municipal election. Our thought is that the communities that are participating in the pilot program would likely be grandfathered somehow once the pilot program is rescinded, but it doesn't look like that currently in state law. So our perception is that the communities that have been participating in ranked choice voting would probably still be allowed somehow. There'd be some modification of the law, but that may not be the case. There is a lot of election bills at the legislature this year, and they may just want to eliminate this entirely, but there still is time if we wanted to run the 2025 municipal election for ranked choice voting, and this was important for council to sort of circle up right after the legislature concluded, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, one of the touted benefits of ranked choice voting is that it eliminates a primary. There are people who think primaries are helpful, though. I mean, it's like people have more opportunities to learn about the candidates.
Fair point. I think there's pros and cons, and that's a fair point. That's the type of public comment that we'd want to receive if people felt that way.
All right. And again, I guess if it's going away, why bother?
Well,
it's just the grandfathering.
Yeah,
clause.
To my point, I think I think the last I checked, there's almost over 20 municipalities that are participating in this program in the state of Utah. And obviously, they're going to have to cross a threshold one way or the other. But nothing would preclude us from participating for a year and seeing how it goes. But that'd be a lot of work. That'd be a lot of work to turn around and potentially then just lose it all over again.
All right. Council will also be deciding whether to approve Deer Valley's request to create 3 public infrastructure districts. These apparently would not impact city taxpayers. So why would the city not allow the resort to go ahead and tax themselves?
The law is created now. The local authority has to, you know, oblige this or consent to this. And I think it's because there could be tax disparities throughout a jurisdiction where you have one area of town that has a different level of tax than another. And that can create some confusion, and it can also create a legacy effect of sort of not supporting initiatives moving forward because one part of your community is sort of out of sync with the other. Now, this is different because It is a resort-based area where the primary homeowners or property owners are going to be secondary homeowners. This isn't like, you know, a lot of school kids. We're not creating a new neighborhood of school kids and families that are going to be living here year-round. So I think that's one of the reasons that we are looking at this. We looked at this favorably when we did the initial LOI with Deer Valley a year ago. I will say, though, you know, you make a valid point. The Utah legislature this year was considering just eliminating local consent or local authority to enable a public infrastructure district. So just taking that out of our hands entirely. That's another initiative that we were able to beat, so to speak. But look, there's pros and cons anytime you're sort of adjusting taxes in one area and not adjusting them in another. Other communities use this tool all the time to support economic development and redevelopment opportunities. You know, here it's a little different given the uniqueness of our community and the amenities that we already have. But we're sort of just sort of processing and moving through the letter of intent that we have at Deer Valley from a couple years ago.
Yeah, so any concerns that if Deer Valley wasn't given the approval to set up these pits, that it then reaches out to MIDA and requests to be part of its project area?
You know, conceivably, any private property owner, particularly of this size or scope or magnitude, I think is likely, you know, looking at the full buffet line of tax increment and redevelopment authority and different types of sales taxes and tools that the legislature has laid out. It's no secret that they have a propensity to want to use public financing to partner with the private sector to create redevelopment opportunities in Utah. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. I'm not aware that Deer Valley is doing anything like that at the moment.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Matt?
The only other thing is I just wanted to, you know, we are interviewing for Planning Commission. We had over 15 applicants for three different positions. And I think it's just a great indication of the public's interest in helping the municipality with something that's really important in shaping the future of our city, reviewing redevelopment applications, updating the general plan, you know, reviewing land management code. So very impressed that 15 applicants are on the hook for us.
Yeah. Two of those are actually reapplying for their positions, and they actually expired last year. So did they just agree to sit on the commission for another year?
Yeah, I mean, commissioners are typically they're seated until otherwise, because there will be gaps and sometimes the interview process. But this one in particular, I think we were trying to have the institutional memory of the work that we had done on the Deer Valley request to amend their MPD and get a conditional use permit for their base area. We had these members that had worked on this project for 2 or 3 years, and we were sort of right at the finish line, and we didn't want to move them off and move in a bunch of people and have to reintroduce all of this material.
Okay. Matt Dias, thanks.
Thanks, Leslie. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Matt Diaskin, Park City City Manager. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. In the studio now with an update from the Heber Valley Chamber, I have Executive Director Dallin Kosher. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's hit some of the upcoming chamber events. First up, March 18th, the Chamber Lunch, a new location. So what happens at this Chamber Lunch? Is it an annual luncheon?
So this is our... it's one of our regular lunches that we do. We've gone from every month to every other month because of a partnership with the Wasatch Back Business University with Park City Chamber. The reason we're moving to a new location is that we usually host these at UVU Wasatch campus, but the room that we're in is going under the knife, if you will, to get some remodel. So we have to move for a couple of months, which is totally fine. So the Zermatt is hosting the event there, and we're calling this our biz quiz. So this is a networking event where as businesses sign up, they share us a little trivia with us. And then we're going to do, it's kind of like trivia night at a pub or a bar where people get to mix and mingle. And then we're going to do ask questions and kind of do like a game at the end to have people just get to know each other's businesses that way.
Okay. It's a member only?
Anybody is welcome to attend. You get a price breakdown if you are a member, and just different costs on the food. So it's pretty good thing for you to come out. We also encourage everybody to come out and check it out for the first time and enjoy, see what the Chamber has to offer for you.
Okay. Again, you do need to register.
Correct.
All right.
We do need to have those RSVP numbers, but this end of this week would be the best time to do that.
Okay. And then coming up is the Ask Heber Community Expo in April. Where does this take place?
This takes place at the Wasatch County Rec Center. We have commandeered 2 volleyball courts and 3 classrooms, and I should say basketball courts. But we have space for up to 72 vendors, and we have about 65 plus signed up now. So we have about probably 8 to 10 left. And we have spaces for nonprofits. We have spaces for, we create a new family fun area with face painting and balloons, you know, to keep the kids entertained while mom and dad enjoy what the businesses are going around. And this is our third annual event. We've done this each time at the rec center, and each year it gets bigger and bigger. And the purpose of this event is to showcase the businesses in Heber Valley and to help our locals get to know who's in town. Like, we hear that all the time. I didn't know we had this. I didn't know we had that. And so this is the one-stop first shop to stop to get to know what we have in our community. So that way you get to know who these businesses are. And when you need those services and products, you know where they are.
Okay. Again, that's happening on Saturday, April 12th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Correct. And that is a free event for people to attend.
All right. Wasatch Open Lands update. What's the latest here?
So yeah, I sit on the Wasatch Open Lands board and servicing the economic development / tourism function of that. I just wanted to give an update where we are. So back in 2018, the community voted for a up to $10 million bond for open space preservation. And really, I think most people were thinking about that in terms of the North Fields. And if you're not familiar with that, those are the big open swath of land between Midway and Heber as you're coming into town. And the idea is we're not necessarily purchasing land outright from people, but purchasing development rights off that land. And so over the last few years, we have actually taken out one $5 million tranche and have allocated that. And then we've actually been able to allocate the next $5 million tranche, but we haven't bonded for it yet. We are, you know, taking the money out. And so, but we have had projects to fill that need. And so one thing that we're looking forward to doing is looking at what other resources are available to help cover those costs, so maybe our taxpayers don't have to burden that all by themselves. And one thing we learned, speaking of a legislative update, as I heard on from Matt's segment, is that it sounds like this legislature has created a new program where it allows for rollback taxes to be used, 100% of that to be used on preservation, open space preservation. Now, there are some caveats with that, like what types and where. And so it is a great resource, and so maybe that helps us stave off how long we need to go before we need to go to that second tranche of $5 million or to bond again. Those are some really neat things for us to balance out and provide for our community. So it's exciting to be able to do that. And we just, at our annual report for the open lands board, pardon me, is that to date we have either secured or encumbered or promised money for up to 623 acres of land in the Heber Valley. And that equals about $66 million of investment. So our $10 million has been leveraged with Utah Open Lands and some Conservancy and all those funds to help us leverage those funds. So we feel pretty confident and proud that those things have happened.
Okay. Just sticking with the legislature, House Bill 456, this was the change in the transient room tax collection. Was this something you were in favor in, I'm guessing?
Well, this is more of along the lines of wanting our community to be aware and what the changes are. So the state legislature has had this ongoing issue to solve and address search and rescue and emergency services in rural communities. And so the tourism industry has been trying to push off any rise in transit room tax, but we, through negotiations and other things, we've settled on essentially a 1% growth in transit room tax, a 0.75% from the state transit room tax, and a 0.25% in local county tax. So overall, as a taxpayer for a hotel or a campsite or Airbnb, they would see a 1% increase in their bill at the end of their stay. What that does is allows for some of those funds for the state to create a fund for search and rescue and emergency services, so that smaller communities which is, would not include Heber or Park City, and who have search and rescue needs, that they can use the transroom tax to apply to the state for reimbursements. And so that's which pretty exciting for those communities. It does create some challenges for some of those smaller communities that where they can't prime the pump in the sense that 100% of their transroom tax can be used on search and rescue instead of promoting tourism. So you got to balance it out, right? How much do you prime the pump so you actually have funds to do that with versus using all of it? So I just wanted our community to know that that is a change that's happening. It will provide additional funds at the county level and also opportunities for search and rescue for other communities as well.
Okay. We also have that state tourism marketing fund.
Yeah.
Is that something that Wasatch County is a recipient of?
Yeah, so each year we do apply for up to, like this last year we got $212,000. I think the max is $250,000. And we use that to leverage our marketing spends. So all that fund has to be spent on out-of-state marketing.
Yeah, we did see a cut to that fund. Is that going to impact the funding you get?
It may. We'll have this, the Utah Office of Tourism hasn't signaled what they're going to do with that yet, but we will take it as a, we'll take anything we can get and be grateful for it.
Okay, and then real quick, the Wasatch Back Economic Summit scheduled for May 13th at the Grand Hyatt Deer Valley. Do we have registration open for that?
It will be opening either tomorrow or sometime this week. We're really close to opening it, and that you can access links to GoHeberValley.com or through the Park City Chamber as well. We have links back to both to registration on both websites.
Okay.
So please come. And
it's always a sellout. So will you have more room at the
we
Grand
do.
Hyatt?
We actually upped it up to 400, which is exciting. So I think that's 50 to 60 more people than we had in the past. So that's a great thing for us to expand our reach.
Okay. Hey, Dallin, thanks for coming in.
You betcha.
Dallin Kosher is the executive director of the Heber Valley Chamber.